As you know, our youths in the church, whether they are your children, grandchildren, nephews, or friends, are going to face real trials when they get to high school and especially at the college level. We are living in an increasingly secular society. You can say the floodgates are opening up. Now everything goes. Now you see all kinds of things in TV you don't really want to see. Even the commercials are getting so bad, and basically seeing less and less all the time. And as we have this increasingly secular society that leaves God out of the classroom and in fact undermines the belief in God, especially in the universities. And professors are quite successful to undermine the faith of young men and women who sometimes can't refute some of their arguments. And so a few of those youths end up believing in God at the end of their university career. Many professors are atheists or agnostics. They're hostile to the Bible, to God. And the kids are not very well prepared with the attacks, especially on the existence of God. They know if they can undermine that, sow seeds of doubt, then they can really work more to undermine a person's faith. We know how important the belief in the existence of God is for our faith. In fact, the Bible tells us in Hebrews chapter 11 in verse 6, I'd like to read it from the Passion Translation, a modern translation that gets it pretty clear. It says, "And without faith living within us, it would be impossible to please God. For we come to God in faith, knowing that He is real and that He rewards the faith of those who give all their passion and strength into seeking Him." Do kids have that passion and strength to really seek Him? I hope they do. I hope they develop it. It's the most wonderful feeling and thing that can happen in your life. I know it happened to me when I was 17 and got that from God at that time. God opened my mind, and I had a passion and strength to seek God above all things. Do we still have that passion and strength to seek Him diligently on a daily basis? It's not easy, but we must. And we want to help those youths while we can, because one day they might leave the home, go to a university someplace, or just whatever they do, get a job, and maybe they will decide not to listen to their parents or to their friends in the church. Instead, they will listen to the siren call of society. That's an allusion to the Odyssey by Homer, where he mentioned about the Greek soldiers and sailors, and they passed this place where there were these women strumming on harps, and they had this influence, and what they were doing is drawing them into the rocks. And so he had to put in his men a wax in their ears so that they wouldn't hear. But he said, I want to hear it, but you tie me up to the central rod, you know, the central mast. And he said he almost went crazy because he just wanted to go there. There is this siren call of society. It's very strong. It's very powerful. And frankly, I would not forgive myself if I kept this information for myself and not cover this subject at least once here in Garden Grove in this way for the benefit of all. After all that are of the faith are preparing to become kings and priests in God's kingdom. You're going to be all educators. Are you getting prepared to teach people about the existence of God? Could you give them proofs that would strengthen their faith? And especially for the youth that are listening in, to equip and arm them with the best proofs there are. So when you doubt about God, that you can remember these 7 scientific proofs of God's existence. Now, it's just been in these last years that I could give this message because many of these discoveries are very recent. I couldn't have given this message quite in the same way 5 years ago because this is cutting-edge information. These are things that have been recently discovered, and they are so powerful. I just finished reading this week a book by Douglas L. He is an MIT-trained physicist and also mathematician who later got a law degree. Now, he was an atheist, but he came across so much of this evidence that he changed. And now he wrote this wonderful book. It's called Counting to God. It's Counting Toward God. This is what he did. In the last 30 years, he got closer and closer to God. And I'm going to be using some of his material as well. So this is only going to be part one because I don't have enough time to cover the 7 points. But we can cover the first 4 and be able to do it in an appropriate way. Remember what 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15 through 16 tells us that we all should do. I'd like to read it in the New Living Translation. 1 Peter 3, 15 and 16, it says, instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks about your hope as a believer, always be ready to explain it. The term explain means to give defense of the faith, that you can defend your faith. Wouldn't it be great if you could just remember these 7 scientific proofs? You could just basically, there is no real argument for these things. Now, people might say, well, yeah, I can't refute it, but I still have a question. That's fine. We respect that. But there is this overwhelming evidence. As you know, here in California, in the trials that they have, they ask the ones who are going to be part of the jury, they say to convict somebody, you have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, which means that you have to be strongly convinced that that person is guilty to declare it. You can't be absolutely sure because nobody was there 24/7 while the crime was being perpetrated. So it talks about beyond a reasonable doubt that all the evidence points one way, and you are convinced that is enough evidence to convict somebody. Well, this is the same way that you can do with the scientific evidence of God's existence. You can prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, which means the evidence points one way. You might not have every detail. You might not have it totally proved because we're only human. We don't see everything. I remember one time when my wife got into an auto accident, and my two daughters were there in the back seat. Our former nanny in Chile was visiting them. So they were occupying four seats, and my wife and Carmencita had picked up the two girls here at the high school. And so they went, and they were going to turn left. So they turned left, but there were some kids getting out of school, kind of going fast. And so they hit her, and it pushed the car into the other one. It was a very low velocity, so it didn't really cause a big crash. And basically, our car, nothing really serious happened. But you know what happens? The kids started, my neck hurts and all of this, you know. Let's get a lawsuit or something. And so the police came by, and one of the storekeepers came out, and after they heard the crash, came out, and he said he saw that one of my daughters was driving the car and not my wife. And so he said, yeah, I saw the one of the girls there next to the passenger side, and she had opened the door, and she must have gotten out. Well, the fact was that my wife was stuck in the seat because it had those automatic seat belts that lock. So you didn't buckle it. It just locked. And so she was stuck there because it didn't work anymore. And so, of course, my daughter came around and opened the door. But that person said, oh, it was the daughter who was driving. Well, when we covered it with insurance, they realized that these automatic seat belts would have caused that. But the thing is, a person was a witness, but he didn't see everything. He only saw one side. So anyways, this is what can happen, that you don't have all the sides that you can see, the whole, you know, crime, but still people get convicted on convincing evidence. The preponderance of the evidence points this way. So it can be the same way with these scientific proofs. They all point one way. And the good thing is that science, by observation, experimentation, and reasoning, they have concluded that this is so, although their interpretation can change, but they can't deny the facts. So let's look at these first four scientific proofs of the existence of God. Number one, science has discovered that the universe had a beginning. This was not the scientific consensus 100 years ago. If you would have polled the scientists 100 years ago, back in 1921, the scientists would have said, no, the universe has always existed. It is eternal. They could point to Newton back about three centuries before, and Galileo and the great scientists up to that time, they all thought this universe had always existed. Even Albert Einstein believed that. The thing is that it was Albert Einstein, when he came up with his theory of relativity, talking about the relationship between gravity and the different laws in the universe, that his equations pointed to an expanding universe. This was back in 1916, 1917. And so when one of the scientists said to Einstein, "But don't you realize what your theory is saying? It's saying an expanding universe." And so Einstein looked at it and he said, "You're right. This can't be right." So what did he do? He added another mathematical figure, what is called a constant, to have the equation end up with an eternal universe, a universe that is not expanding, that has always been the same. Well, unfortunately, that only lasted like 10 years because a gentleman by the name of Edwin Hubble, up here in Pasadena area, up above here in the San Gabriel Mountains, up in the top, you have the famous Mount Wilson Observatory with the largest telescope in the world at that time. It was 100 inches across. And Hubble started examining all of the space and the sky, and he started looking and saying, "Well, these galaxies are all expanding outward." And so Einstein came, because he didn't want to believe it. In 1929, he made the climb up to Mount Wilson, peered through that Mount Wilson telescope, and these are his words. He said, "I now see the necessity of a beginning." I see that the universe had a beginning. This is what they didn't want to admit. Because if there was a beginning, there was a time when the universe did not exist. It came into being. It's just like winding a clock back in time or winding a movie back. If it's expanding, then if you go backwards, you get to the point where there's a moment in space where the whole thing expands outward. And that's what they have concluded. But if there is a beginner, that everything has a beginning here, then you have to have a creator. It has a cause that it started sometime in the past, but before that, it did not exist. And so that points directly to an all-powerful being that brought this universe. And what does Genesis 1:1 say? "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." See, they didn't take into account what the Bible had said 2,400 years before. Actually, it's 3,400 years back in the time of Moses, when God inspired Moses to write down those first words in Genesis. There was a beginning. Then there was more confirmations of an expanding universe. One of the discoveries that sealed the deal and made it convincing was in 1965. Two Bell Lab scientists had an antenna out there that they were going to measure the temperature out in space and everything, and they had this static. Wherever they pointed that antenna, it had the same static. And what they discovered was that this was the remnant of the heat that had been emitted at the beginning of that expansion of energy and matter, which started everything. And that has been confirmed. So scientists, of course, don't want to admit this, and they start trying to speculate that maybe there are all these multiverses out there that somehow we are just one of them. Because then they would have to not admit that this is all just a beginning, that you have other universes out there, but there's no evidence to that. And then you're just pushing the problem back. Because, okay, if you have others, who created those? Because they had to come out of somewhere. So anyways, this is a very powerful evidence. It's interesting that one of those scientists that discovered this remnant energy that originally got the Big Bang going, this is Arno Penzias, Nobel Prize of Physics. He said later, the best data we have about the big explosion, the big expansion, what's called the Big Bang, are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the first five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. So he said, as a scientist, I look at the Bible, it describes perfectly the expansion of the universe and all of these laws that are involved in it. So this is a huge proof. There is no other suitable explanation that you have a cause that began the universe and something had to cause that, had to develop that. A cause does not come out of nowhere. Someone had to be that initial first cause. And that's what we call God, in the beginning. God, not evolution, not the steady state of the universe. No, in God, it says there, started the universe, created the universe. Secondly, the second scientific proof, again, this one's not 100 years ago that people started changing their minds. This one, they only started changing their minds 50 years ago. Science has discovered the fine-tuning of the universe. It's another huge, uncontested proof. All the evidence coming in day after day shows more and more evidence of that fine-tuning of the universe. This happened about 50 years ago when cosmologists, astronomers that study the universe, are called, Brandon Carter in 1973 found that these unrelated constants in physics, you can call them laws as well, have one strange thing in common. They are precisely the values you need if you want to have a universe capable of producing life. Life is very delicate. It can be destroyed. You have to have all the right conditions for life to thrive as it does. Scientists have found there are about 30 constants or laws of physics that govern the universe. All have been found to be independent of each other. In other words, one doesn't cause the other. Everyone is independent. The expansion rate of the universe is one of those constants. that the universe obeys. You have the weight of the electron, of the proton, of the neutron. Everything has to be calibrated to the nth degree. It's like a delicate Swiss watch. All of the motions have to be perfectly, all the cogs have to fit correctly. I actually, about 5 years ago, had a trip with my daughter Debbie. She came to visit us, and they brought their big recreational vehicle with them, and the trailer, or I guess what they call it nowadays, I don't remember, mobile. Yeah. And we had to drive the truck with that big trailer behind her. Pardon?
Fifth wheel.
Yeah, the fifth wheel. And so I wanted to go by Tucson. We visited friends of the church there, but also I wanted to visit Biosphere, which was this famous, and it's still there. It is a huge biodome, and it has seven different climates of the world. I mean, it has one section which is like Antarctica, and you know they will have the different animals of that place. They have the snow and the ice, and it's as chilly as if you went to Antarctica. You also have the tropical area where you go in and it's hot, humid, just like if you were in the middle of a jungle. You have the desert area, and there were seven different climates. And then you had this huge control room with all of these knobs, and they have to be correct because all of this climate, you have to have the humidity right, you have to have the temperature right, the pressure right. And what we see in this universe is the equivalent of a huge biodome, this type of biosphere, but with all the knobs perfectly calibrated. So how do you get 30 knobs if you went into the biosphere and you say, oh, isn't that wonderful what has just evolved on its own to get all of these things right? No, you would think there's an intelligence behind that. Someone who was coordinating all of these constants so we could have life, so we could be here today with the temperature, with the sunlight just right. Somebody spent a lot of time tuning all of those dials so they work together in unison. Everything has to fit perfectly. I'd like to read Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 25. In the contemporary English version, God is speaking to Jeremiah. He says, Jeremiah, I will never break my agreement with the day or the night, or let the sky and the earth stop obeying my commands. Yes, it's God the one that set everything up. And everything is faithfully following his commands. That's why we are alive today. So that's a very powerful proof, scientific proof of God's existence. Let's go to the third one. Science has discovered the miracle that is the origin of life. Scientists have no real idea how it happened. Even the atheist and rabid evolutionist Richard Dawkins admitted, quote, nobody knows how it got started. Talk about life. In his book, Climbing Mount Improbable, pages 282 and 283, he admits And he, of course, is one of these anti-gods, anti-Bible, everything. But he admits, what did he say? Nobody knows how it got started. Even the greatest scientists, nobody can say it. Now, this discovery about the miracle of the origin of life really has about 60 years. When the DNA was discovered inside the cell back in 1953. Took them about 7 years, maybe 1960, 1961, when they realized that that DNA was the instruction manual for the cell. Excuse me. Science has never found non-life creating coded information. It doesn't matter what area in the world, outside, nothing can create coded information except an intelligent being. Now, we can create coded information. Every time we write, we're creating coded information. And I can take it, and you're reading your laptop or you're reading your Bible. That is coded information. And nothing in nature, there is no law of physics that can create this type of coded information. From the most primitive cells to human beings, did you know that all have the same operating system? That even the humblest bacteria uses the same operating system. It has the same code that we have in our DNA. It also has the humblest bacteria has, it uses the same four-letter component code. It uses the messenger RNA, which now is pretty popular because of the vaccines, but it actually is able to code that and create proteins with it. A bacteria does it like a human being. And you go back in time to the most primitive bacteria, and they still have this sophisticated system with all of this coded information to make them work. The origin of life is really a chicken and egg problem. To get life, you need both the code and the machines to process the information. If you have the machines, how are they going to be built without the code? And if you have the code, how can you have a code without the machines producing it? You need both at the same time. Some of the code gives instructions on how to build the proteins that read the code. So how could it all simultaneously arise all at once? And this is what you see from all types of life. I'd like to read this from that book I mentioned about Counting to God by Douglas L. He says, all living cells on earth, without any known exception, store their hereditary information in the form of double-stranded molecules of DNA. Long unbranched paired chains, formed always of the same four types of letters. We take a piece of DNA from a human cell and insert it into a bacterium, or we take a bacterial DNA and insert it into a human cell, and the information will be successfully read. It's the same, you know, you start out with a Mercedes-Benz and you end up with a Mercedes-Benz system. There's nothing primitive about it. It's the same machinery. How can that arise by chance without some super intelligent being developing it? Tell me, are there any takers on this? What is the alternative? It says, no simple cell began the process. It started with sophistication from the beginning. And so this is the third great proof that we do have a God that exists. In Matthew 10, verse 30, I'd like to read in the easy reading version. It says, God even knows how many hairs are on your head. To be able to develop all of these incredible machineries and for the origin of life, we need someone that really cares to go through all the trouble and to care for us that way. A mother doesn't know how many hairs on the head of a child. There are over 100,000 normally. Who's going to take all the trouble? God knows how many. That's how much he cares about his creation. He says not a bird drops dead that he's not aware of. And the final proof that we have is that science has proven that technology of life is run by millions of robotic machines, exquisitively programmed. There's nothing left to chance. It's all programmed to the last detail. And the more I study this, you're going to see here in a moment a film about some of these molecular machines. And just consider how much has to be programmed in each one of these tiny little robotic devices. Because it can walk. The cell has a highway system that extends out, and it has these little ridges or knobs where these robots can walk along. And you can imagine they have to have a type of sensors and a type of a computer to be able to walk and to do everything it does. That's why I have a smartphone here. Now, this smartphone is so primitive. In comparison, it can't walk. It can't do things on its own. This little thing that's created out of proteins and that actually has also sensors. It has this central processing unit, which is automatous, which is automated. Just like now you talk about these autonomous vehicles that self-drive. You know, we still can't get that right without the thing wrecking or doing something wrong. And here are all the world's greatest engineers trying to come up with this. And here, every one of these little creatures is automated. It has sensors to know how to walk. And the scientists that study this mentioned that if you took one of those little robots and, okay, you enlarge them to the point where they'd be kind of like the size of a car, they would go faster than your car would. on a highway. That's how fast they are. Not only that, but they're so much more efficient than any of these engines that we have, which are basically 10 to 15% effective. You know, they burn still about 80, 85% of all the fuel. Well, these little robots have 60% efficiency rate. And so I want you to see that this technology clearly points to an all-wise, all-intelligent, all-powerful being that put all of these things together. When I saw this for the first time, I remember when I got my little grandson, Andrew, a little, you know, they love cars. So you get one of these that has a little track. But this one wasn't just smooth. It had knobs on it. So this one with the truck or the car, it can do a loop. And not very fast. It doesn't need the centrifugal force. It can do it just from the cogs all attaching. This is the same way it has. So I want you to see this now. It's about 5 minutes long. And then we'll go back because a picture is worth 1,000 words. And remember, we're on this last proof, the fourth one, about the technology inside the cells prove the existence of God.
These are tiny molecular machines, and they are doing this inside your body right now. To understand why, we have to zoom out.
Every day in an adult human body, 50 to 70 billion of your cells die. Either they're stressed or damaged or just old. But this is normal. In fact, it's called programmed cell death. But to make up for all these lost cells, right now, billions of your cells are dividing, essentially creating new cells. And that process of cell division, also called mitosis, well, it requires an army of tiny molecular machines. So let's take a closer look.
DNA is a good place to start, the double helix molecule we always talk about. This is a scientifically accurate depiction of DNA created by Drew Barry at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. If you unwind the two strands, you can see that each has a sugar phosphate backbone connected to the sequence of nucleic acid base pairs, known by the letters A, T, G, and C. Now, the strands run in opposite directions, which is important when you go to copy DNA. Copying DNA is one of the first steps in cell division. Here, the two strands of DNA are being unwound and separated by the tiny blue molecular machine called helicase. Helicase literally spins as fast as a jet engine. The strand of DNA on the right has its complementary strand assembled continuously, but the other strand is more complicated because it runs in the opposite direction. So it must be looped out with its complementary strand assembled in reverse, section by section. At the end of this process, you have two identical DNA molecules, each one a few centimeters long, but just a couple nanometers wide. So to prevent the DNA from becoming a tangled mess, it is wrapped around proteins called histones, forming a nucleosome. These nucleosomes are bundled together into a fiber known as chromatin, which is further looped and coiled to form a chromosome, one of the largest molecular structures in your body. You can actually see chromosomes under a microscope in dividing cells. Only then do they take on their characteristic shape. Otherwise, the DNA is more strewn inside the nucleus. The process of dividing a cell takes around an hour in mammals, so this footage is from a time lapse. You can see how the chromosomes line up on the equator of the cell. Now, when everything is right, they are pulled apart into the two new daughter cells, each one containing an identical copy of DNA. Now, simple as this looks, the process is incredibly complicated and requires even more fascinating molecular machines to accomplish it. So, let's look at a single chromosome. One chromosome consists of two sausage-shaped chromatids, containing the identical copies of DNA made earlier. Each chromatid is attached to microtubule fibers, which guide and help align them in the correct position. The microtubules are connected to the chromatid at the kinetochore, here colored red. The kinetochore consists of hundreds of different proteins working together to achieve multiple objectives. In fact, it's one of the most sophisticated molecular mechanisms inside your body. The kinetochore is central to the successful separation of the chromatids. It creates a dynamic connection between the chromosome and the microtubules. For a reason no one's yet been able to figure out, the microtubules are constantly being built at one end and deconstructed at the other. While the chromosome is still getting ready, the kinetochore sends out a chemical stop signal to the rest of the cell, shown here by the red molecules, basically saying, this chromosome is not yet ready to divide. The kinetochore also mechanically senses tension. When the tension is just right and the position and attachment are correct, all the proteins get ready, shown here by turning green. At this point, the stop signal broadcasting system is not switched off. Instead, it is literally carried away from the kinetochore down the microtubules by a dynein motor. That's the walking guy. This is really what it looks like. It has long legs so it can avoid obstacles and step over the kinesins, molecular motors that walk in the opposite direction.
Personally, I'm astounded by these tiny molecular machines, how they're able to routinely and faithfully execute their functions billions of times over inside your body at this exact instant. I'm also amazed by the scientists who were able to work out how this happens in such detail that we could create realistic depictions of them like you saw in the animations in this video. But perhaps the most amazing thing is just how much is left to be discovered, like figuring out how exactly the chromatids are pulled to opposite ends of the cell. There is still so much that we don't quite know.
Well, I hope you were impressed with that. Again, these things are cutting-edge technology, information. By the way, those microtubules are the highway system, the freeway system of the cells. So all of these different molecular vehicles, they're carrying things, but they can't do it on their own. Because remember, the cell is basically an aquatic medium. I mean, it's not like there's air inside. It's not like these things can actually float in the air. No, they're floating in a liquid. And so you need these highways where they can all know to get to a certain place and not just be carried away by the liquid. So I hope you understand the complexity of all of this and the love that God had to create all of this, to have us live whatever years we have on this earth. And we're still made out of matter, but it's marvelously created, as Psalm 139 says, I am wonderfully and marvelously created. Well, the Bible told us about the technology that God formed us from the mother's womb, and it is all a great miracle that takes place. So, to summarize these first four scientific proofs, The first one is the origin of the universe, that it had a beginning. That is undisputed today. The fine-tuning of the universe, that it's all carefully calibrated. I mean, to the nth degree. When you look at some of these laws that interact, and they've been calibrated to just thousands and thousands of a degree in precision for it to work. The origin of life, the miracle that it truly is. That could not happen by any inferior way. And finally, the technology that's inside the cell. Technology of life. So I'd like to conclude reading Hebrews 11:6, but this time from the New Living Translation. It says, "And it is impossible to please God without faith." Well, faith has to be based on something. Faith is not blind faith. It is reasoned faith. Something that you look at the evidence and it makes sense. Anyone who wants to come to him must believe that God exists, and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him, have the right heart, that have submitted to him, to realize who are we in comparison to God. He called us out of this billions of people on this earth, gave us his precious truths, gave us his precious promises, that coming kingdom of God that we're all looking forward to so much. So to conclude again, just one more scripture, Colossians chapter 3. This is a good scripture to remember as we begin to prepare for the Passover, which is a little more than a month away. It's hard to believe. Remember, February is a very short month. Colossians chapter 3, verse 1. This is a scripture that has just come to my mind lately very much. It says, verse 1, "If then you were raised with Christ, if you were baptized and forgiven, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth, which are passing. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God." It was the baptismal death that we all went through. "When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory, glorified as a spirit being. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry," because you can worship things like coveting, and it can become an idol. "Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them. But now you yourselves are to put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him, where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, nor free, but Christ is all in all. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another if anyone has a complaint against another. Even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection." And it is. Love which caused God to create this universe, to put all of this effort into having us one day in his glorious family. That's why Paul says, when we consider that coming glory, all these other things pale into insignificance. Our problems, our difficulties, they pale into insignificance when you think about the wonderful future that is ahead. Have a wonderful Sabbath.